welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host. Our special guest author, new to the show, Deacon Stephen Doran, MD, To Die Well, A Catholic Neurosurgeon's Guide to the End of Life, published by our friends over at Ignatius, naturally available from our EWTN religious catalog, EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic. Great to meet you.
Oh, it's so great to be here. My honor, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
That's okay. Our audience would recognize you for being on with Father Mitch, talking about this very, very important topic. And as you know, we're dealing with so much of these questions of euthanasia we see going on in the world, yes. and the issues of death and how Catholics deal with it. And one of the things that struck me is you talk about a Catholic perspective on death. Is there a unique Catholic perspective, and what is it?
Well, I think the Catholic perspective on death, I would go back to St. Robert Bellarmine, who said, you know, to die well, one must live well. Mm-hmm. And I think the Catholic perspective of death is one that recognizes that our preparation for it begins at our baptism. Mm-hmm. Yes, there can be deathbed conversions, that's all wonderful, but really our preparation for death begins at our baptism. And so it's a lifetime of frequenting the sacraments, seeking reconciliation when we've sinned, seeking reconciliation mm-hmm. with those we love who we've harmed. Getting to know the mind of God by studying His Word through the Bible, that's the Catholic perspective on death. It's a lifelong purpose.
Now, you say that my purpose in writing this book is to draw from my experience to present the Catholic perspective. What do you think is unique that you bring because of your role as a physician?
I've been blessed to be in a career where I engage with and interact with people who either suffer some acute injury or hemorrhage, or they have a malignant brain tumor, so I'm confronted with the possibility or probability of impending death. And so hoping then to kind of bring it through the lens and perspective of a person of faith, and mm-hmm. as it turns out, an ordained
right.
person.
Right.
And so bringing those things together hopefully provides a unique perspective on that.
Have you found any times when you ran into conflict between you being a neurosurgeon and being a deacon?
Not yet. I'm mindful of people's sense of what their, you know, their own privacy, their own desires, and so I really want to be mindful of that. It takes just the tiniest bit of door opening to recognize that what people really want. I've never had a patient refuse prayer, never. Mm-hmm. But I don't come in and say, hey, you want to
right.
pray? You
right.
know. But the littlest thing they'll say, and the door opens wide. Right. And so I've not run into problems, but I'm listening.
Right. You also talk about, my hope is that this book will not only answer questions, but give readers pause. Pause to?
Well, the problem is that I would say the impetus for this book was this reality where I would be talking with a family member whose spouse had suffered mm-hmm. a hemorrhage, and they had not thought about the possibility of death, much less contemplated it, much less prayed about it. Despite the fact that that person might be, you know, fairly advanced in age, the denial of the reality of death is amazing to me. I mean, the only two things in life that are sure are death and taxes. We spend a lot of time thinking about taxes.
Right.
We spend very little time thinking about, much less praying about, death. And so mm-hmm. that's the purpose. It's kind
right.
of like, maybe I need to give some thought and prayer to this.
So in the time that you've been practicing, have you seen it people become less focused on death? Or is this something that's just been like that for as long as you've been practicing? Or is it there a cultural youth orientation, and because of the materialistic world, the idea, I'm going to be hanging on for all the gusto I can get here?
Yeah, I would say there's parts of all of that that you just said, but what I think is really feeding into this is what I would call the medicalization of death and dying.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the process of dying and death was something that was anticipated, expected, treated, now when you're sick, mm-hmm. your illness is the enemy, and we're going to do everything we can to beat the enemy. We're going to do surgery, we're going to do medicines, and when you lose that war, and you will lose that war, I'm going to move on to the next thing. So we have this commodity type of relationship between what the patient's expectations are and how that care is delivered, and that feeds into the ultimate reality that the war against death and disease is lost, and you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And that medicalization, I think, is probably, and it permeates all things that are wrong with medicine right now.
So when you watch Gilligan's Island, did you relate to the professor?
Well, I kind of like Marianne and Ginger, but that would be...
I'm not talking about who you wanted to date.
Oh, I'm sorry. I like Gilligan. I thought Gilligan was awesome. I thought the professor was a nerd. Sorry.
Yeah, okay. Well, I was just wondering about that. You would think the medical school would have made death more real to you. You're
yeah.
talking about when you first went there, and
yeah.
it was kind of book smart, and
yeah.
then you started dealing with
yeah.
death, but you really weren't dealing with death. Explain.
Yeah. Well, you know, so you go to medical school, you start, and you're introduced to your cadaver, mm-hmm. literally, and you spend this time learning from the person who is gracious enough to donate their body, and you would think that reality of death would become like right in your face, but it becomes really abstract, actually. Mm-hmm. It becomes, this isn't a person, this is a collection of, you know, parts and pieces. I know without sounding crass.
So is that something your mind does to protect you, consciously or unconsciously, or?
Yeah, there's probably a component of that, but I also think, just to be honest with you, you're just so overwhelmed with material. You're just keeping your, trying to get your work done, keep your head above water. And I guess that, I mean, I think life in general is that way. Why don't we speak about or think about or pray about death? We're so consumed with everything else in life, mm-hmm. we just don't draw back and think about, okay, wait a minute, what's important here? And so the experience as a medical student is both of that, you know, kind of a defense mechanism, but also like, you're just trying to get through the
right.
day.
So when you jump to being somebody who's actually going through your residency, and you talk about coming face to your grieving spouse and children or ongoing punch in the gut. Death was tragic, often anticipated, seldom contemplated in advance. While death was undoubtedly more real to me at this point, it remained uncoupled from life. How so?
Again, as a resident, you're just, unfortunately, people were in front of you and can become tragically reduced to a task, right? This is what I need to get done today. This is what how am I going to take care of this? And so it comes down to just this, not investing the emotional energy into the reality of, you know, this person just lost their spouse. Mm-hmm. I know that, but I got to go over here and put out this fire. Putting out fires kept me from, I think, really mm-hmm. understanding. But also I think an important part of this is own personal journey in faith, right? Mm-hmm. If I look at my personal journey in faith, if I'm honest with myself, I was, you know, Catholic, I went to Mass, you know, all that. But as my own faith life deepened, mm-hmm. as I grew more in love with Christ, as I grew more in love with His Word and studied His Word, things, you just have a different perspective.
People became more important to you, they were going through.
And the humanity of that person,
right.
You couldn't just turn your eyes off to the humanity, the tragic that's going on. Now, granted, you can't get too involved right. every time, but yeah, you start seeing each person you're interacting with as a beloved child, a beloved, you know, son or daughter of God, and you start thinking, mm-hmm. I have to remember that.
Now, who's Mike Lewandowski, and what do you mean he lived a holy life in your mind and had what you called a glorious death?
Mike was my father-in-law,
okay.
and Mike was a repairman, telephone repairman, and simple, not simplistic, simple in that his values were clear, his goals were clear, and a super holy man, mm-hmm. just a holy man, and experiencing how he went through his death, surrounded by family, but surrounded by everyone who wanted to be with him because he was holy, and there was scripture being read and mm-hmm. hymns, and it was just like, wow, I think this is what death ought to be if it can be. And granted, it doesn't always happen that way, mm-hmm. but his life was one of a life of holiness, just like Robert Bellarmine said, to die well, you have to live well, and he lived a life of holiness.
Okay. And you talk about him dying a good death. You said modern society has a paradoxical attitude towards death. What do you mean?
Well, on the one hand, we celebrate death in a weird way. We're just, you know, as we were visiting, you know, this idea of Halloween, for example, where death is put into this kind of grotesque thing, or music celebrates death in an odd way. There's this preoccupation with horror movies and things like that. So the sense of death in that way that society has is a distorted sense of death, mm-hmm. you know? Whereas death as a, oh wait, this is how my life ends, mm-hmm. obvious, but it's a transition point. Something happens after death. You either go to nothingness mm-hmm. or you're going someplace. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what's missing is this, you know, we celebrate death in all these weird ways, but don't really think about death as the end of our
existence.
So why
do you think there's that fascination? Because we could say that that there's a greater fascination with death in that sense, that way, than it certainly was when I was growing up as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I don't know, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of factors at play there. Mm. I think the ante keeps getting upped and up in the more sensational, and
right,
it's like
right.
everybody's, you know, kind of amping everything up. And so I think that feeds into it. Mm. I think there's despair that we deal with on so many levels that sometimes leads us to a sense of you know, there's nothing left to live for, and I think a generalized sense of despair can lead to that. I think that's a great question.
Right. Okay. And also sometimes the vertical dimension of our faith, mm-hmm. having and trying to get more of that in there, because people are looking for something greater and beyond. I thought it was interesting too, and you alluded to it too, making the rounds.
Right.
The idea, and almost that is in a negative sense.
Yeah. It's funny. I think as a patient, you don't necessarily realize what's going on, but the way rounds work, especially in training institutions, there's this kind of entourage of doctors and medical students mm-hmm. and nurses who literally stand out in the hallway, discuss the case. You know, so the junior resident or medical student, you know, presents the case. This is Mrs. Smith with blah, 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 blah. And then the staff asks questions and kind of pontificates on what's going to go on. Mm-hmm. And then you walk in the room and it's, hi, Mrs. Jones, how you doing? Fine, see you later. And so this person who's been kind of, again, comes back to this what I call medicalization of right. of death and dying, the spiritual realities of this person aren't even considered, because you're a tool for us to learn from, we're going to help you, but that sense of that person's humanity, is it just doesn't reach anybody's consciousness.
You say the purpose of this book is to address important issues yet often overlooked considerations. The first part focuses on moral questions around death and dying, including end-of-life medical decisions, topics such as suicide and euthanasia. The second part is devoted Catholic spiritual understanding of dying and to go to the sacraments and the rites. Now, the first part is much bigger than the second part of the book.
Yeah, and not necessarily by design. Maybe it reflects my own inadequacies, you know? I don't know. I mean,
there's a lot to deal with, I think, practically in the first part, because people are dealing with so many more things than they were before, right?
They are. And I do think life in general and death in particular has become more and more complex, more and more decision-making that's needed. And quite honestly, it's something that I live on a daily basis that I hopefully am able to articulate and distill down into an understandable way.
And the kind of things you run into, medically assisted nutrition, and you talk about the idea of the vegetative state.
Right.
And you say vegetative is not meant to be derogatory. That word itself creates an image of a person who's a vegetable. Mm-hmm. A better term for this condition, which is gaining favor, is unresponsive wakefulness syndrome. Yeah, I mean, that's what people's impression. Somebody says they're in a vegetative state, they think, well, they might as well be a vegetable.
Right, right. John Paul condemned the use of that word, and because what it does is it takes away from their humanity, takes away from the fact of who they are mm-hmm. as a creation of God, and it turns them into an inanimate object.
Right.
You know? And so it's a very pejorative term. Unfortunately, it's easier to say that. You know, people will still use that, regrettably. So.
Right, and it's also interesting because you talk about a particular case here, Mark, who died of complication from his brain injury.
Right.
He did not die from starvation. Such was not the case with Terry Schiavo, which we covered that clearly when that happened, and our friends with her brother. She did not die of her brain injury. She was starved to death.
Right.
And the Catholic perspective, you talk about the Holy Father, Pope John Paul II, clearly endorsed the necessity of providing nutrition and hydration to this group of patients. I remember Monsignor Smith, of late memory, used to say on these kind of things out of New York, he said, well, don't bother with that. Just don't open up the window. If it's cold enough, you give them pneumonia, they'll die of that.
Yeah, that's regrettably, people can get this fatalistic perspective that someone nearing their death has become disposable, you know.
A burden,
they're taking up space, let's just kind of get this over with.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you say that not every patient should have a feeding tube placed, because if they can no longer eat or drink on his own. So how does one decide? Isn't that the tough part, figuring out what should I do? I mean, most people want to do the right thing.
Right. And I think there's a lot of subjects in there that are this. They're things that need to be looked at on an individual basis. Now, I'm not advocating for situational ethics, but there's nuances. And I love the Catholic intellectual thought that it's able to embrace nuance. A lot of them aren't. So there's nuances that go into, okay, is it appropriate in this situation? If yes, so. If not, why not? Whether it comes to medically assisted nutrition, withdrawing care, any of those things. And so that speaks to, this is what a lot of people want to know about. Well, should I have a living will? Mm-hmm. What should I do? How am I going to get what I want when I die? And the problem with living wills is that there's no way you or I can anticipate the circumstances of your death. No way.
Right.
And there's no way for you or I to anticipate, is a feeding tube appropriate or not? You need
what your perspective might be at that time, which may be different. Talking about something and having it come to fruition are two different things.
Exactly. And so ideally, you're the one who's gonna make that decision, right? Mm-hmm. You have capacity to do that, and that's the ideal situation. But the event that you're not, you need to have someone, a durable power of attorney,
right,
who knows you, loves you, trusts you, and agrees with and is knowledgeable about your Catholic thinking. So that in that situation, if you're in a coma, is a feeding tube appropriate? Well, let's look at the big picture. Let's decide, because you can't, it's not a check mark type of thing. Yes, no, yes, no.
Right. Each of the examples you talk about in the book illustrates that a patient's personal experience determines whether a given treatment is overtly burdensome. The ratio between benefits and risk can shift over time as well.
Yes. You think about it, for example, I think people understand this. Someone's diagnosed with cancer and say, okay, we're going to go through the treatment for this. And they do fine. Cancer returns, switch treatment, cancer returns again. At some point, people say, you know what, I've had enough. That treatment has become burdensome. Right. And so I think people intuit that with those types of examples, but the type of burdensome versus non-burdensome can be applied in so many different areas too.
Right, well, you are a little suspect of the utilitarian use of that term, because it starts to get where people are made to feel as if maybe they're a burden in the euthanasia movement especially and people. You say often a decision to resuscitate, this under ventilators, and place a patient on ventilators made in the heat of the moment. Decision to remove the ventilator on the hand requires emotionally difficult deliberation. So are you saying somebody shouldn't be put on a ventilator right away?
No, I'm not saying that at all, but I'm saying that the default usually is if you come into the emergency room with something that you can't sustain yourself, you're going to be put on a ventilator, and then we figure things out later. Now, there's exceptions to that. Someone who comes in has a disease process with their age where it's clearly that's been defined that they wouldn't want that. But once a patient has been placed on a ventilator, that doesn't mean it has to continue, you know, indefinitely.
Right.
And as the dust settles and it becomes clear what's going on, then removing the ventilator can be and oftentimes is a very appropriate decision. We make that decision with some frequency. What's hard about that, though, is I think that the person making that decision feels like I'm doing something to kill this person.
Right,
they take
on
this unwarranted burden that you didn't create this problem, you know, and we've collected information, we realize what this is futility and not. We are afforded the dignity of dying, and sometimes that dignity means that you withdraw care. Absolutely.
Palliative care, hospice, pain control at the end of life in Chapter 3. While receiving palliative care, patients can still receive medical treatment tended to cure or to control underlying illnesses. And you make that point because hospice isn't like that,
correct.
Right?
Correct. Yeah, I think the hospice movement was wonderful. I think it identified a way by which we can help people through the dying process and honor them. But it became a little bit too stark in that, well, you know, yes, someone is dying, but their death isn't imminent. We want to take advantage of the hospice care, but yet we still want to treat. And so that's where palliative care finds this middle ground. It's been a great addition to.
And what is palliative care?
Palliative care, I guess in a general sense, is the recognition that someone has a disease or an illness that is going to take their life. They're dying, but that it's not like there's a time frame associated, but someone has something that is going to lead to their death.
Right.
It allows, though, continued treatment for that process, but yet recognizes that there are things like pain control or support services and things like that can be coupled with that.
Right.
Because the other extreme of do everything to the bitter end is, you know, that's one extreme. The other extreme, do nothing. It's finding this sweet spot in the middle.
Right, or like you say, a hospice situation, which is we'll help the person feel better, but we are not going to do anything to try to improve their situation in the sense of them recovering.
Right.
I thought it was interesting, too, because in the section you talk about the principle of double effect and pain control, because obviously when you're dealing with morphine and some of these things like this, though they can help you with the pain, they can also hasten death in certain instances. Right.
Yeah, it's a really important thing because some people want to say, well, there's no difference in giving someone morphine to control their pain and they stop breathing versus let's just do assisted suicide or euthanasia. The crux of the matter is what is the intent of the person giving the medication?
Right.
The intent is super important because we recognize that we do interventions that have an anticipated but unintended consequence. And so that's where that principle of double effect is used not only there. We're talking about in abortion
when
things
dealing
like that.
With or trying to deal with the health of a child and a mother simultaneously in a situation like that.
And this is what I love so much again about the Catholic intellectual tradition, this ability to engage in nuance, right? For you know that the fact that well, wait a minute, let's sit down and look at this critically. And there are nuanced positions, there are difficult things. And so the Catholic intellectual tradition is what came up with double effect principle, which is now used widely in secular philosophical centers too.
So you have a section on brain death. Mm-hmm. You say, as new data is acquired regarding the definition of death, further moral reflection is necessary, and the moral certainty needs to be reviewed of let's at a point in time where a couple of our popes had kind of said brain death makes sense, but there's some questions about it now, right?
Well, both popes have said that it appears. Mm-hmm. It appears to be, John Paul said, a valid, you know, definition of human anthropology. But they also say that the church doesn't make scientific decisions.
Right.
And I think with technology, we've been able to support people a lot longer who are thought to be brain dead. I'm actually participating in a symposium going to be in February with Georgetown, National Catholic Biotech Center, Catholic University, that's going to kind of come back and look at this again, and in light of new technology, in light of what we know about people who've appeared to have survived while still being brain dead. What does that really mean? Mm-hmm. And it turns out probably part of their brain was still alive, but it's not right. measurable.
Well, you talk about, and related to that, in having to do with organ donation, which right. a lot of people deal with, as an act of love, but both also caution, these were the popes, about organs being taken and individuals must be totally dead at the time, and there are some concerns that people have raised in the last few years over the fact that too many, you know, whether there's somebody circling waiting for the organs, and it means well and the intentions are good, but are we rushing someone's demise because of that?
Yeah, the challenge is that, again, it comes back to this idea you have to have trust in your caregiver, either for yourself or for your loved one, and you don't want to have the influence of a third party influence their decisions, and so do not at all want to undermine people's trust in the organ donation system. It is indeed an act of love to donate that. I just think we're being challenged now with, mm-hmm. okay, how are we going to measure whether someone is truly dead or not?
Right. You talked on page 71, you talk about a buzzword these days in Catholic circles is accompaniment. Mm. What does it really mean, and how does it play out in real life? Why'd you decide to bring that up in the middle of this chapter on perinatal death?
Well, the reason why, I had this really beautiful conversation with a friend of mine who is a maternal fetal specialist or perinatologist, and his job is to take care of a woman who's pregnant, and the only reason why they're there is there's something going on, either with her or with the pregnancy. And he talks about these situations where it becomes clear, for example, that say maybe a baby has a what's called a fatal fetal anomaly, that they're not going to live or won't live for a long time. And so most people in his field, quite frankly, make their living doing terminations. He said, nobody in my office does terminations, even the non-Catholic ones. But instead, that initial reaction of, I just want this gone, it, you know, come back in a week. Okay, come back in a week. Well, I still don't like this, but, you know, fine, we'll give anyway, over a period of time, and just being there in a non-judgmental way, but encouraging him to say, let's just think it through, you know. By the end of that, the majority of people end up saying, this is my baby. Mm-hmm. I want to see this baby, I want to hold this baby, knowing that that baby isn't going to survive. So it's this beautiful transformation right. of someone being present with them, speaking truth, but in a way that's gentle, in a way they can hear, that ultimately results in a beautiful ending of a tragic situation.
So that's the accompaniment you're kind of talking about in an appropriate way. It's interesting you talk about also in a chapter on euthanasia, good old Jack Kevorkian and his suicide machine. Yeah. Well, he's the Stone Age now compared to what they've got. I mean, got these pods in Europe where you just take care of yourself, and we're seeing up in Canada an incredible, I think it was some percentage of almost 4.1% of people who died in Canada 2 years ago were euthanized.
Yeah, medical aid in dying is the euphemism they like to use. Now accounts for it.
I like to call it MAME, murder is closer to it.
I mean, people always say, the slippery slope. Just look to Canada. If you want to see what the slippery slope can look like, look to Canada and see what's happened there with euthanasia.
It's interesting, too, because you point out the fact that initially, after World War II, the whole eugenics and the kind of euthanasia went down because of the bad press the Nazis gave
it.
But it seemed like it's been revitalized.
It has, and I think it comes down to people in general wanting to control their life, control their destiny or whatever, and they see, well, if I'm going to, you know, this idea that my life is my own is the part of the problem, right? We believe that, no, my life is Christ. It's not my own. It's His. And so the mentality, though, this is my life. I'm going to control all I can about my life, including how I'm going to orchestrate my death.
Right. So. Which weird. You talk about the autonomy and the individualism. Mm-hmm. Now, I always think it's interesting, this dichotomy between I'm an individual, I can do what I want, but I'm doing it for the good of my family and the good of the state. So how do those things cross over?
Well, this is why I think if we're not grounded in some truth other than what's going on in our own head, right? Mm-hmm. And the truth that we have within our faith, within Scripture, within the teachings, within the catechism, yeah, then we can make judgments that keep all those things in tension, because they can be in tension.
Right.
There can be what appears to be conflict amongst those various parties, but I wouldn't say there's conflict, there's tension. And we can work through those right. things and do work through those things.
Now, you have several myths you're talking about with physician-assisted suicide. Mm-hmm. One of them is physician-assisted suicide is available only for terminally ill patients. That's what everybody thinks. They're thinking of somebody in a vegetative state.
Right. Yeah, and even when it's gotten worse since I wrote this, in Canada, for example, you can now get, in a sense, an advanced directive for assisted suicide if you develop dementia. Because one of the things, you have to be able to be competent to make that decision. So now I can say, well, you know, in the event, if I get dementia, kill me. Mm-hmm. You know, and so no, the people who are receiving it gets expanded all the time, more and more. Mm-hmm.
So in the second section, you talk about Catholic spirituality. One of the things is the idea of dying well. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to say the opposite. What does it mean to have a good death? Mm-hmm. In the eyes of the world, a good death is one where you're peaceful, pain-free, surrounded by family and friends, all good, all great. Okay. But that's not the measure of a good death. That's not, because that might not happen. And we know the saints and Jesus Christ himself, by that measure, had a terrible death.
Right.
But he had the most perfect death, where he was abandoned, he was in pain. And so the measure of a good death is not comfort. The measure of a good death is union with God. Okay. and towards the Trinity.
Right, and denial of suffering is not part of it, because mm-hmm. our Lord suffered and the saints suffered. Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Deacon Stephen Doran, M.D., To Die Well, A Catholic Neurosurgeon's Guide to the End of Life, again, published by our friends over at Ignatius Press. Check the book out. Of course, it's available through our catalog, EWTNRC.com, for all things Catholic. I'm Doug Keck. This has been EWTN's Bookmark, and we shall see you next time. Thanks for joining us.